Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just a few seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's time for Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. Nice lineup of guests today. We'll start off with an excerpt from a new radio program that we're going to be airing here on KTOO. It's called Writer's Showcase, and we'll be hearing a couple of the performances. What happened here was that Alaska writers' writing was read by actors at the KTOO studios. We recorded it, and we're going to turn it into a radio show that will start airing on Monday at 3 p.m. in place of Juneau Afternoon this coming Monday. So today we're going to hear a little preview of that, so stay tuned for that. Also, Katie Bosler will be dropping in from the university to tell us a little bit about spring classes. We'll also have a business profile by Alaska Pure Sea Salt Company, a new company down in Sitka that's producing flake salt for the first time in Alaska. And Crystal Borland is doing a healthcare presentation this Sunday. She's working with NAMI. She's our navigator for the Obamacare program, and we'll hear about that later in the program. So stay tuned right now for National Native News, and then we're on to Juneau Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. It will now be more difficult for groups to challenge Native-themed mascots and logos in Wisconsin public schools. Governor Scott Walker signed a bill Thursday that changes a three-year-old law that had resulted in some districts dropping mascot names like Chieftains and Redmen. Shemaine Mills reports on the new law.
No longer will the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction hold hearings on complaints about race-based nicknames. Instead, an agency controlled by the governor will, the Department of Administration. Critics will have to prove Indian mascots and logos are discriminatory and gather signatures in local petitions. The Mukwonago School District went to court to keep its Indians nickname. Sam Hall is an attorney with a firm that represented the district.
This bill now creates a fair process so that if those nicknames are ever challenged again in the future, that school districts have a legitimate opportunity to keep them.
Barbara Munson is a member of Oneida Tribe. She chairs a task force on mascots and logos for the Wisconsin Indian Education Association. Munson calls the governor's decision harmful to Native children and other minority groups.
It's unconscionable that our schools teach our children to participate in and tolerate race-based stereotyping.
Governor Walker cited free speech concerns in his decision to sign the bill. In a written statement, he said a better alternative is to educate people about how certain phrases and symbols that are used as nicknames and mascots are offensive. For National Native News, I'm Shemaine Mills.
A long-time standoff between the owner of Strawberry Island in Lac des Flambeaux and the tribe is a step closer to being resolved. Ken Krall from WXPR Public Radio in Wisconsin reports.
This week, the tribe's land management office told the tribal council they had come to an agreement to acquire Strawberry Island for $250,000. The tribal council passed a resolution approving the sale. The island is on the National Register of Historic Places and was the site of a fierce battle between the Lakota Sioux and the Ojibwe people. The tribe has wanted to buy the land from the Mills family but could not come to an agreement. Tribal officials say the sale is contingent on specific provisions of the agreement. A dispute arose in 1995 when the family applied for the paperwork to build a home on the island, considered a key piece of Ojibwe history. Lac des Flambeaux tribal spokesperson Brandon Tomes says the island has deep historic roots.
Part of the migration story from when the tribe migrated from the Atlantic coast down along the St. Lawrence River and into the Great Lakes region, it holds a spiritual significance within the tribe.
Tomes says some contingencies need to be met, but they're anticipating a large celebration in the spring to note the return of the island to the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. In northern Wisconsin, Ken Krall reporting.
The Chickasaw Nation is one of 40 tribes selected to take part in a federal housing study. As Kurt Gortney with KGOU reports, Congress called for research into housing.
Researchers have selected more than 500 households in the Oklahoma Tribe's territory to take part in a study sponsored by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. The national survey started in early December. It's intended to provide information for policymakers and tribes about improving housing conditions for Native American families. The voluntary study is in response to a congressional mandate to learn more about the housing needs of Native American, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian communities. HUD officials say the study would use several types of information, including both primary and secondary sources. The final report from the study is expected by December of next year. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney in Oklahoma City.
On this day in 1935, the U.S. Department of the Interior approved the Constitution and bylaws of the Pueblo of Santa Clara. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is accepting art for the Alaska Native Art Auction, February 20th, 2014 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event to buy art. Proceeds benefit National Native News. Learn more at knba.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon, as promised. Here is our first excerpt today from our new series, Writer's Showcase. You'll be hearing the whole show on Monday afternoon at 3.
While our show's mission is to showcase Alaskan writers, when we heard New York writer Paul Auster's Auggie Wren's Christmas Story, we chose to include it. The piece was originally published in the New York Times on Christmas Day in 1990, and tonight will be read by Perseverance actor Enrique Bravo. Enrique was born in South Texas in a split time between New York and Juneau over the last 7 years. This season, he joined the staff at Perseverance Theater as the artistic company lead and will be performing in his 15th production in Juneau this winter as Brick in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The scene for this portion of Auggie Wren's Christmas Story is at a New York delicatessen. Writer Paul Auster and acquaintance friend Auggie Wren have sat down to lunch. Paul is under deadline and desperate for a Christmas story he's agreed to produce for the New York Times. Auggie, a cigar shop clerk who quotes Shakespeare and takes artful pictures, says he has the best story you ever heard. While Enrique will read from Paul Auster's point of view, note that most of the dialogue will be Auggie's. And while Auggie isn't his real name, he claims the rest of this story about how he got his camera is true.
It was the summer of 72, he said. A kid came in one morning and started stealing things from the store. He must have been about 19 or 20, and I don't think I've ever seen a more pathetic shoplifter in my life. He's standing by the rack of paperbacks along the far wall and stuffing books into his pockets of his raincoat. It was crowded around the counter just then, so I didn't see him at first. But once I noticed what he was up to, I started to shout. He took off like a jackrabbit, and by the time I managed to get out from behind the counter, he was already tearing down Atlantic Avenue. I chased after him for about a half a block, and then I gave up. He dropped something along the way, and since I didn't feel like running anymore, I bent down to see what it was. It turned out to be his wallet. There wasn't any money inside, but his driver's license was there, along with 3 or 4 snapshots. I suppose I could have called the cops and had him arrested, had his name and address from the license, but I kind of felt sorry for him. He was just a measly little punk, and once I looked at the pictures in his wallet, I couldn't bring myself to feel angry at him. Robert Goodwin, that was his name. In one of the pictures I remember, he was standing with his arm around his mother or grandmother. In another, he was sitting there at age 9 or 10, dressed in a baseball uniform with a big smile on his face. I just didn't have the heart. He was probably on dope now, I figured. A poor kid from Brooklyn without much going for him. Who cared about a couple of trashy paperbacks anyway? So I held on to the wallet. Every once in a while, I'd get a little urge to send it back to him, but I kept delaying and never did anything about it. Then Christmas rolls around, and I'm stuck with nothing to do. The boss usually invites me over to his house to spend the day, but that year, he and his family were down in Florida visiting relatives. So I'm sitting in my apartment that morning, feeling a little sorry for myself, and then I see Robert Goodwin's wallet lying on the shelf in the kitchen. I figure, what the hell? Why not do something nice for once? And I put on my coat and go out to return the wallet in person. The address was over in Borum Hill, somewhere in the projects. It's freezing that day. Now I remember getting lost a few times trying to find the right building. Everything looks the same in that place. And you keep going over the same ground thinking you're somewhere else. Anyway, I finally get to the apartment I'm looking for and ring the bell. Nothing happens. I assume no one's there, but I try again just to make sure. Wait a little longer, and just as I'm about to give up, I hear someone shuffling to the door. An old woman's voice asks, "Who's there?" And I say, "I'm looking for Robert Goodwin." "Is that you, Robert?" the old woman says. And then she undoes about 15 locks and opens the door. She has to be at least 80, maybe 90 years old. And the first thing I notice about her is that she's blind. "I knew you'd come, Robert," she says. "I knew you wouldn't forget your Granny Ethel on Christmas." And then she opens her arms as if she's about to hug me. I didn't have much time to think, you understand. I had to say something real fast, and before I knew what was happening, I could hear the words coming out of my mouth. "That's right, Granny Ethel," I said. "I came back to see you on Christmas." Don't ask me why I did it. I don't have any idea. Maybe I didn't want to disappoint her or something. I don't know. It just came out that way, and then this old woman was suddenly hugging me there in front of the door, and I was hugging her back. I didn't exactly say I was her grandson. Not in so many words, at least, but that was the implication. I wasn't trying to trick her, though. It was like a game we'd both decided to play, without having to discuss all the rules. I mean, that woman knew I wasn't her grandson, Robert. She was old and dotty, but she wasn't so far gone she couldn't tell the difference between a stranger and her own flesh and blood. But it made her happy to pretend, and since I had nothing better to do, anyway, I was happy to go along with her. So we went into the apartment and spent the day together. This place was a real dump, I might add. But what can you expect from a blind woman who does her own housekeeping? Every time she asked me a question about how I was, I would lie to her. I told her I found a good job working in a cigar store. I told her I was about to get married. I told her 100 pretty stories, and she makes like she believes every one of them. "That's fine, Robert," she would say, nodding her head and smiling. "I always knew things would work out for you." After a while, I started to get pretty hungry. There didn't seem to be much food in the house, so I went out to a store in the neighborhood and brought back a mess of stuff. A pre-cooked chicken, vegetable soup, a bucket of potato salad, a chocolate cake, all kinds of things. Ethel had a couple of bottles of wine stashed in her bedroom, and so between us, we managed to put together a fairly decent Christmas dinner. We both got a little tipsy from the wine, I remember, and after the meal was over, we went out to sit in the living room where the chairs were more comfortable. I had to take a pee, so I excused myself and went to the bathroom down the hall. That's where things took yet another turn. It was ditzy enough doing my little jig as Ethel's grandson, but what I did next was positively crazy, and I'll never forgive myself for it. I go into the bathroom, and stacked up against the wall next to the shower, I see a pile of 6 or 7 cameras. Brand new 35mm cameras, still in their boxes, top quality merchandise. I figure, this is the work of the real Robert, a storage place for one of his recent hauls. I've never taken a picture in my life, and I've certainly never stolen anything. But the moment I see those cameras sitting in the bathroom, I decide I want one of them for myself. Just like that, and without even stopping to think about it, I tuck one of the boxes under my arm and go back into the living room. I couldn't have been gone for more than 3 minutes. But in that time, Granny Ethel had fallen asleep in her chair. Too much Chianti, I suppose. I went into the kitchen to wash the dishes, and she slept with a whole rack, snoring like a baby. There didn't seem to be any point in disturbing her, so I decided to leave. I couldn't even write a note to say goodbye, seeing that she was blind and all, so I just left. I put her grandson's wallet on the table, picked up the camera again, and walked out of the apartment. And that's the end of the story. "Did you ever go back to see her?" I asked. "Once. About 3 or 4 months later, I felt so bad about stealing the camera, I hadn't even used it yet. Finally made up my mind to return it, but Ethel wasn't there anymore. I don't know what happened to her, but someone else had moved into the apartment and he couldn't tell me where she was. She probably died." "Yeah, probably. Which means that she spent her last Christmas with you." "I guess so. I never thought of it that way. It was a good deed, Augie. It was a nice thing you did for her. I lied to her. And then I stole from her. I don't see how you can call it a good deed. You made her happy. And the camera was stolen anyways. It's not as if the person you took it from really owned it. Anything for art, eh, Paul?" "I wouldn't say that. But at least you put the camera to good use. And now you got your Christmas story, don't you? Yes. I suppose I do. I paused for a moment, studying Augie as a wicked grin spread across his face. I couldn't be sure, but the look in his eyes at that moment was so mysterious, so fraught with the glow of some inner delight that it suddenly occurred to me that he had made the whole thing up. I was about to ask him if he'd been putting me on, but then I realized he'd never tell. I had been tricked into believing him, and that was the only thing that mattered. As long as there was one person to believe it, there's no story that can't be true. You're an ace, Augie. Thanks for being so helpful. Anytime, he answered, still looking at me with that maniacal light in his eyes. After all, if you can't share secrets with your friends, what kind of friend are you? I guess I owe you one. Nah, you don't. Just put it in the way I told you. You don't owe me a thing. Except the lunch. That's right. Except the lunch. I returned Augie's smile with a smile of my own, and then I called out to the waiter and asked for the check.
So there is an excerpt from our new radio series. You'll be hearing the whole thing, an hour-long presentation, on Monday at 3 p.m., this normal time for Juno afternoon. That'll be our special show on December 23rd. It's called Writer's Showcase. The inaugural program of the thing is going to be holiday-themed, and the Alaskan authors who will be read will be Heather Lindy, Jeff Kirsch, Clint Farr, and Joan Pardis, and Rockwell Kent. And Christina Apathy's coming in to read, Shauna Strausser, and Ryan Canaro. So a great new opportunity to basically have something like Writer's Showcase on the air here at KTOO. Tune in.
Support for this program comes from GCI Mobile Services, offering packages for the HTC One phone. GCI, serving Juneau downtown on Seward Street and in the Valley.
Be part of the studio audience December 20th at 5 p.m. for Forum at 360. The topic is Living the Language, featuring Tlingit speaker and clan leader David Katzig, UAS Tlingit language teacher Marsha Hotch, UAS assistant professor of Alaska Native Languages Lance Twitchell, and linguist Alice Taff. Forum at 360 will be recorded for later broadcast on 360 North Statewide TV and KTOO-FM. That's Forum at 360, Friday, December 20th, 5 p.m. at KTOO.
You're in tune with KTOO. It's about 18 minutes after 3 o'clock. We're in the middle of Juno afternoon, and my first guest here live from the studio is none other than Katie Bosler of UAS fame. And Katie is here to bring us up to date for the second time, I think. We're going through this, and we're going to talk about the spring schedule at UAS and all the other exciting things, I guess, that Katie knows about that are happening in the spring. The university, I think, is right on the brink of being closed for a couple of weeks.
Yes, thank you, Pat.
Spiff things up out there while everyone's
right. Gone. Well, let me let everybody know that classes start for the spring semester January 13th, but we will be closed. Campus closure is this coming Monday, the 23rd of December, until the 6th of January. We reopen Monday the 6th. But I just want to let people know that you can still register for classes online or search for classes online and. As I said, the first day of class is Monday, the 13th of January. But we do have several classes that are open, and just want to let people know that we especially have some really exciting stuff happening with the Department of Career Education, the School of Career Education. So coming right up, I think January again. I know January seems so far away at this time of year, but it really isn't. So they're holding a weekend, January 17th, 18th. Now, that's a woodworking workshop for beginners where you'll be introduced to the safe operation of basic hand and power tools for light construction. I could use some of that. Okay. And then woodworking 1 and 2 is a course that's being offered starting January 13th, and it goes through May 3rd, and that is Tuesdays from 6 p.m. to 10:45 p.m., so that's a night class, and that's introduction to woodworking and woodworking machines. And then there's other construction.
I got to stick a note in here. If you haven't been inside that facility over there, there's a real opportunity here.
This is a technical education center.
The technical education
downtown.
Facility in this, the one right across from the high school. It is amazing. We have better equipment in there than you can possibly imagine. I've worked in that auto shop for about the last 5 or 6 years, and it's like owning a garage. It's amazing what you can do in there. Yeah, it really is.
Okay,
and the
you're
going to
have
shop,
some friends, it sounds like.
The wood shop is just as well equipped as the auto shop, and you walk in there, they have the latest stuff, and it's one of the really wonderful things about it is there's a terrific emphasis on safety. You can do some serious damage to yourself with woodworking tools, and they really train and work hard to make sure that everybody who uses that equipment is safe, and they show you how to use your own equipment safely as well. So it's a real opportunity to get up close to some great woodworking equipment in this course. And like everything else that they do at the Technical Center, it's just they have really good instruction, really great equipment. So it's a good opportunity.
Well, thank you. You know, gosh, Pat, as the PR and marketing director at UAS, you really helped me out here. You do more than interview. It's like, okay, go, you go. All right. And, well, speaking of that, other construction technology classes being offered this spring 2014 semester include you can earn a building or energy retrofit technician occupational endorsement in one semester if you take three courses between the 13th of January and May 3rd. And those courses include cold climate construction, building diagnostics testing, and residential renovation, retrofit, and repair. And cold climate construction is kind of interesting. You know, it's all about insulating to make your home or your dwelling more energy efficient. Also, there's a course happening this spring, kind of a condensed course that's January 13th to February 8th, Mondays and Wednesday evenings, and then on Saturdays all day, and that is residential wiring. So those of you who wanted to wire your place, this is your course. And there's also, if you are interested in AutoCAD training, there is an intermediate AutoCAD course being offered this spring and Wednesday evenings. And there is a construction planning and scheduling course. Well, I know we could use that in my house. There's a lot of talking about construction, but not a lot of construction going on.
Information. Your place?
Yeah. But anyway.
Sounds like an Alaskan home.
Yeah, maybe that just comes with the territory. So, yeah, that sounds very attractive. Construction planning and scheduling, that is offered Monday evenings for the spring semester. So if you want any more information about that, you can go to uas.alaska.edu, and then you can look at Explore Campuses and Schools tabs and look at the School of Career Education, where you'll get some email addresses and contacts and phone numbers, but also more information about what they have to offer. And you can look into registering online also at uas.alaska.edu/schedule.
Just another quick note.
Yes.
These courses, some of them, tend to really fill up fast.
Mm-hmm.
So you said you're reopening on January 6th.
Yes.
That means that you could register. Can you register online in between?
I think you can.
You also might
need some personal attention, too. And I know this is kind of late because, like I said, our office is closed as of Monday for a couple of weeks. But we are open, you know, this evening at the 796-6100.
796-6100.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. If you have any questions. And then also, I should let you know that there are some arts and sciences courses open as well, and that includes Alaska Native Languages. And as you're probably well aware, our head of our Alaska Native Languages department, Lance Twitchell, has inspiring articles quite often in the Juneau Empire, and if that isn't enough to get you inspired to take Tlingit, the language of the land, I don't know what would be. And so that's always we always have openings in those courses as well. And I'm seeing if there's anything else I should tell you. Do you have any quick questions?
Just probably want to talk a little bit about the pottery courses that are extremely popular. People like to sign up for those.
Yeah, I know a lot of people.
And the other, I think you probably have drawing classes in the spring and like that. So there's a number of offerings in the
arts
school.
There's always good art classes, and those are attractive you know, to people who are maybe are retired, semi-retired, or already have their degrees, or just a kind of an interest in art. And I know I've got some other courses.
And then, of course,
to tell you about here.
Registration mm-hmm. for students who are ongoing has already been open for a bit, and most folks, I hope, have
yes.
taken care of their next semester needs and like that.
Yes, yes.
So just a quick note to anyone yeah. who's thinking of mm-hmm. beginning a college education with the January term, which is entirely possible.
Yeah.
I think you want to be there on January 6th, because if you haven't registered for the spring term, you may be surprised at A, how easy it is, and B, how critical it is that you get the classes right away, because some of them do fill.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's worth stopping by the Novotny one, stop and seeing what's available, or giving a call again, 796-6100. And then other courses that are open in arts and sciences include economics, Native art history, and language courses, more language courses in Spanish, French, and Russian.
Hmm. So if you're planning a vacation next mm-hmm. summer or next winter, perhaps you should bone up on the language now.
Yes, yes.
So you now have a fairly full language staff.
We do. I mean, look at that. Here. You know, we got Tlingit, Spanish, French, and Russian.
Yeah, so.
And lots of English classes as well.
That has not always been the case. UAS has had kind of staffing problems with the language courses at times, and so right now I think everything is staffed up nicely, and so it's possible to continue on with those courses.
Yeah, yeah, and also that just did bring to mind when I think of the English department. I know, for example, one of our staff members here at K2 and Karen, Scott Burton, is also an adjunct professor. And he will be teaching a really interesting course on nature writing, getting out into the field and writing about the natural environment, be inspired by people like Ed Abbey. And that will be offered in the spring as well.
And I think we should quickly mention the fact that Sound and Motion will be back in the spring.
Yes.
And you've got you've already got some acts lined up for that. This is the ongoing thing that happens down the rec center on usually on a Friday night.
Yes. I thank you for you. God, you're good. Sound and Motion, our spring arts series, kicks off January 17th, Friday, the first week of school, and we're very excited to let you know that a trio from Seattle will be coming to the rec center. They're called the Mayhem Poets. And, you know, listen up, I know there's a lot of poetry fans listening, spoken word. These guys are an absolute blast, and we are inviting the public. This is a student-organized event, student activities, but kind of collaborating with Sound and Motion this year, so this should be great. So mark your calendars, UAS Rec Center, Friday, January 17th for Mayhem Poets. And speaking of poetry, the Poetry Slam, the Woosh K Monthly Slam for February will be held also out at the UAS Rec Center.
Okay. So, once again, the cultural events on Friday nights continue rolling year-round. We have sort of lecture series in the fall and then music and motion in the spring.
Right, but the difference with Sound and Motion, the spring series, is that it's not every Friday. It's kind of sporadic, you know, maybe a couple Fridays every month, pretty much, between January and April.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's a great little campus, folks. Great opportunities to pick up a course, great opportunities to continue your college education, pick things up where you left off 15 years ago and finally finish the degree, get that done with,
and move on
to the next thing in a row. Yeah,
that's a whole other subject that we will be telling you more about real soon.
Well, good. y'all come back, you hear?
Okay. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 20th of December, 2013. It was on this day, 1880, the first electric streetlights in New York City lit up a stretch of Broadway between 14th and 34th Street from Union Square up to Madison Square. It would later become known as the Great White Way, lit by 15 carbon arc lights installed by Charles Brush and his Brush Electric Light Company. He'd built his first arc lights back when he was in high school, and he'd worked on them for years trying to refine them. They were called arc lights because the light was produced by a current traveling between two electrodes. The lights were all installed on this day, 1880. They were going to be lit at 5:30 in the afternoon. The lamps were installed on tall iron posts, about twice as tall as the old coal-powered lamp posts. There was a crowd gathered. The order was given, and the street flared into light. There were thousands of Christmas shoppers out. They wrote in the New York Times, the great white outlines of the marble stores, the mazes of wires overhead, the throng of moving vehicles were all brought out with an accuracy and exactness that left little to be desired. It's the birthday of W.B. Yeats's great love, the Irish revolutionary Maud Gonne, born in Surrey, England, 1865. They met when they were both 25 years old. He fell in love with her right away. He was in love with her for the rest of his life, William Butler Yeats. She was tall, beautiful. Yeats wrote, I had never thought to see in a living woman such great beauty, a complexion like the blossom of apples. In response to one of Yeats's marriage proposals, Maud Gonne told him, you would not be happy with me. You make beautiful poetry out of what you call your unhappiness, and you are happy in that. Poets should never marry. Years later, she wrote a letter to him and said, our children were your poems, of which I was the father, sowing the unrest that made them possible, and you the mother who brought them forth in suffering and in the highest beauty. And it was on this day in 1803 the Louisiana Purchase was completed for $15 million, about 3 cents an acre, from Montana all the way to the port of New Orleans, doubling the size of the United States. Here's a poem for today by Ellen Bryant Voigt, entitled Daughter. There is one grief worse than any other, when your small feverish throat clogged and quit. I knelt beside the chair on the green rug and shook you and shook you, but the only sound was mine shouting you back, the delicate curls at your temples, the blue wool blanket, your face blue, your jaw clamped against remedy. How could I put a knife to that white neck? With you in my lap, my hands fluttering like flags, I bend instead over your dead weight to administer a kiss so urgent, so ruthless, pumping breath into your stilled body, counting out the rhythm for how long, until the second birth, the second cry, oh Jesus, that sudden, noisy, musical inhalation that leaves me stunned by your survival. A poem by Ellen Bryant Voigt, Daughter, from her collection The Forces of Plenty, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Twenty-six minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is not here. My next guest is in Sitka. Online with me right now on the telephone is the proprietor of a wonderful new company down in Sitka called the Alaska Pure Sea Salt Company. Jim Michener is with me. Jim.
Good afternoon, Pat.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So, gee, isn't salt just salt, Jim?
Not at all. Nope. You know, 15 or 20 years ago, I might have thought salt is just salt. But once you've tasted the difference between a real sea salt and not that industrialized stuff, you can really, really tell a difference. It has a profound difference in taste and how it affects your food.
So this was all just a mistake on your part, according to your webpage.
Well, it was a little serendipitous, yeah. My wife and I on our honeymoon just accidentally left a pot of water on the wood stove a little too long up in Hoonah Sound and started to form salt on the surface of the pan. What was a novel creative idea at the time, some many years later, is now a business in Sitka making a flake-style sea salt.
Now, as I understand it, you've managed to find an outside audience for this. There are a number of chefs in the Pacific Northwest who are using this as what they call a finishing salt. What's a finishing salt?
A finishing salt is different than a table salt in such as that you're not going to cook with it. You're going to sprinkle it on top of food after the dish is prepared. It's not to say you couldn't cook with it, say, for instance, in a soup, but the texture of the crystal is really critical, and it has a great crunch to it. And if you allow it to melt, it's just not taking full advantage of the type of salt that it is.
So what's flake salt? Because you refer on your website to the fact that you're producing flake salt, and this is the only flake salt that's being produced in Alaska? Or
it is, yeah. And the first in the Americas to be produced. Mm-hmm. It is actually the crystal structure are actually small, hollow pyramids. They aren't cubes at all. And so with your finger, it's very easy to crunch them. But the idea is that we don't smash them down in a grinder. We do not crush them with our fingers. Just sprinkle lightly on food. And when you bite into that salt crystal, it has a pleasing little crunch to it. And then having the salt sitting on top of the food, it brings out the flavor of the food a little more intensely than if we're hidden in the food.
So I'm assuming that if you're going to use a finishing salt in a dish or something like that, you put a little less salt into the main preparation.
Absolutely, yeah. We cook with little or no salt and then use finishing. There are some things that really need to be salted every step of the way when you're cooking. But you can cut back a little bit on that, and for some foods you don't need to salt at all. And then just a light sprinkle at the end either. It happens a lot in restaurant kitchens. Before the chef puts the dish out to the runners or to the front of the house staff to get out to the table, they'll put a nice little sprinkle of good finishing salt on there. And that's what we do at home, a bowl of finishing salt by the range and then one also by the table.
Now, additionally, you're also doing smoked salts.
We are. You know, we're really proud of our flake salt. It was, you know, the better part of a decade's work to learn how to create that nice, light, delicate pyramidal flake. But there are also three other salts we kind of keep in our stable of Sitka salts, and one is alder smoked. And it's just as simple as smoking it over an alderwood fire to impart that smoky richness to the salt. And then we also have two other salts, one that's made with wild hand-picked blueberries, our Tongass blueberries. And lastly, in the spring, we make one with Sitka spruce tree tips, the spruce tips.
I don't want to steal any proprietary secrets here, but how do you make a blueberry salt?
That's a proprietary secret, Pat.
I'm now minding my own business, Jim.
You know, really what it comes down to is just at the later stages of salt production, we work the berries in. And that was a little bit of an effort to get that one. So I remain a little vague on it. But I will tell you that the only thing that's in a bag of that salt is Sitka Sound seawater that's been carefully evaporated and wild hand-picked blueberries. There are no other additives.
Well, an amazing new business. I'm really pleased to hear that you're finding an export market. Are you beyond the United States? Are you going overseas with it yet?
We have not gone overseas yet. Nope, we're you know, getting a pretty good presence in the Northwest. We've got a good presence in Alaska and a pretty good presence in the Northwest, and moving south and east from there. You know, we've got some retail locations on the East Coast and down deep south, but just trying to fill in everywhere in between, and then we'll look at possibly exporting. That's another big chunk of the puzzle to deal with that we just don't have time for now.
Jim, the product is called Alaska Pure Sea Salt. Where can you find it here in Juneau? Do you happen to know?
You know, we've got about a dozen locations in Juneau. Downtown, some of the stores downtown that have it are Annie Kales and the Fudge Company. And I'm going to be leaving people out. I apologize, Tracy's Crab Shack. And then out in the valley, we're at Gourmet Alaska, also at Super Bear. And Red Onion.
Okay, at least those places and possibly some others.
Definitely others I forgot.
Alaska Pure Sea Salt, it's in on the website I'm seeing like a plastic container that's flat-bottomed and a big blue label on the front of it, unless it's the alder smoked, in which case the label is brown and the sea salt is a little bit darker color.
Correct, yep, and then green and kind of a reddish for the blueberry and the spruce tip.
Okay, and so those are products that we can find here on the shelves in Juneau, Alaska, as well as, I'm sure, all over Sitka, and surprisingly, out in places in the Pacific Northwest, you may walk into a gourmet restaurant and see the fact that Alaska Pure Sea Salt is being used as the finishing salt on the menu. Jim, congratulations on starting a business and making it go, even though it was a horrible mistake to begin with. And I love the comment on your thing that it took you and your wife several sessions of marital counseling in order to be able to keep the company together long enough to get it all to market.
It's been a challenge. Thank you for giving me a call.
You betcha. Thank you for telling us about it.
All right. Take care.
See you later.
Next writer tonight is Susie Gregg Fowler. Susie couldn't wait to leave Juneau after high school, but in time discovered there's no place like home. She and her husband, artist Jim Fowler, raised their daughters in Juneau, where four generations of her family live within five blocks of each other. Publication credits include the Christian Science Monitor, Cirque Journal, Tidal Echoes, and Windfall, and she is an award-winning author of 9 children's books. Her latest book is Arctic Aesop's Fables, 12 Retold Tales. Tonight's piece, No Joke, was published in Skirt Magazine in December 2011 and will be read by Katie Bosler. Katie is a volunteer DJ on KRNN-FM, a writer, and the PR and marketing director at the University of Alaska Southeast.
He's no romantic, my husband. We'd only been an item for a couple months when that insight hit me over the head. Picture a candlelight dinner in my tiny apartment. The two of us seated on the floor at the coffee table across from each other. Dinner is a smorgasbord of snacks, lover's treats. Olives, smoked oysters, gourmet crackers, special cheese, and wine. The music of a favorite Canadian singer spills into the room. Hey, I didn't say I wasn't a romantic. Jim looks across the table, shakes his head, and says in a husky voice, I can't believe it. Sometimes you just look so beautiful. My heart almost stops. Really? A prior marriage and divorce had left me bruised and disappointed. I rarely felt beautiful, but I see something in Jim's eyes. This is magic. I don't know what to say. His words dance around my brain. Sometimes you just look so beautiful. But spells, alas, are easily broken. He pauses only a moment before saying, and then again, other times. End of magic moment. Curtain comes down on that picture. I must say, however, that to Jim's credit, once he realized that I was hurt, that I felt like the butt of a joke just when I was most vulnerable, he felt all over himself apologizing. It was just that he couldn't resist a punchline waiting to happen. That's his credo. I learned to be prepared. Lest I seem to be painting a sad picture, I must say that Jim's ability to laugh at a wide range of foibles, pretensions, and fantasies, including his and mine, has taught me to take myself much more lightly. This, in turn, has made my life easier, better, and a whole lot more fun. So he's not romantic. So what? I know Jim's sense of humor and his style so well these days, I can anticipate the one-liners before he speaks. I know his repertoire of jokes and often begin rolling my eyes before he opens his mouth, sensing as I do what's coming. He is quick with unexpected quips or puns too, but even with his new material, I can guess the tenor of that remark brewing. And as he's aged, he has also learned that there are times for silence. But I have been amused on several occasions knowing that he's holding his tongue while someone pontificates and imagining, almost like thought transference, the quip he longs to make. I guess I've internalized his sense of humor. Our daughters share my skill at reading their father, and sometimes we'll all groan before he even starts a familiar story. He accepts our teasing with his typical good humor. And for better or for worse, Jim's predictability is woven into the fabric of our family life, and the tolerance and affection we have for each other. That is, after all, comfort, not to mention entertainment value in this predictability. And he can, of course, predict our reactions too. But there once was a Christmas no one could have predicted. It's a memory that still possesses a glow, a kind of halo around it when I think of it, although it occurred many years ago now. Amidst the chaos of the opening of stockings, the crumpled wrapping paper everywhere, and the music of my mother's old Harry Simeon chorale record playing in the background, as it still does every Christmas, never without a groan from Jim, my very predictable husband took my hand and led me to a wrapping paper-free spot on the carpet and asked me to sit down. What on earth was this about? He sat opposite me, took both my hands in his, and looked deep into my eyes. Shades of the moment 20 years earlier, I knew I was about to become the butt of a joke and steeled myself. I wasn't going to get suckered in this time. No one can say I don't learn from the past. And then Jim began to recite, "Come live with me and be my love. And we will all the pleasures prove that valleys, groves, hills, and fields, woods or steepy mountain yields." This wasn't happening. Jim doesn't memorize poetry. Okay, maybe a limerick or two. Poetry is my thing. "And we will sit upon the rocks, seeing the shepherds feed their flocks by shallow rivers to whose fall melodious birds sing madrigals." He continued. Time held still, I swear. The dog and cats quit rustling through the gift wrap. The girls were motionless. At least I think those things happened. Or maybe I was just suspended in my own personal snow globe. A magic place. And there in that magic place, Jim recited to me all of the passionate shepherd to his love. His hands trembled, or was it my hands that trembled? His eyes never left mine. He left me breathless. And the children witnessed yet another miracle, their mother speechless. There was no punchline. A Christmas surprise? Oh, yes. The best gift ever, indeed. Romantic? Oh, my, yes. Does it balance out all the other jokes at my expense? I might have to get back to you on that one. But it did remind me that the possibility of surprise always exists. You can't prepare for it. You don't know when it's coming. You can only be grateful, delighted, surprised.
Well, that was the second excerpt from this wonderful new program that we have here at KTOO. It's going to be airing Monday in place of, as the Juno Afternoon presentation on Monday, December 23rd. It's called Writer's Showcase. And what you'll hear on Writer's Showcase is the same formula as selected shorts that's on KTOO radio in the evening. We have Alaskan writers who are going to be read by Alaskan actors. So it's a great little thing. That was Katie Bosler reading a piece. You'll hear much more of that if you tune in on Monday at 3. Right now, we're in the middle of Juno Afternoon. It's about 12 minutes before 4 o'clock. I'm Pat Moore. I'm your host today for Juno Afternoon, and I'm excited to talk to our next guest who's going to be conducting a really important event for us all here in Juno this Sunday. Crystal Borland is here. She's the insurance navigator. She's hired by the United Way of Anchorage. She's working out of the NAMI offices here in Juneau. And Crystal is the person, is the go-to person for making your way through enrolling in the health insurance marketplace. Hi, Crystal.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what are you going to be doing Sunday?
So Sunday we are meeting at the downtown library. They are partnering with us to help people who are uninsured or underinsured get insured. So this is an enrollment event. So I'll be starting with a short presentation about the new health insurance marketplace. Maybe you know it as the Affordable Care Act marketplace or the Federally Facilitated Exchange or Obamacare. It's under lots of different names. So we'll do a short overview of that and then actually have 15 laptops on hand to start the application process with people.
So, Crystal, we hear a lot of news about the system, and it's possible that people think it's completely down on and unusable. I don't think that's absolutely true. What's the status of the system at this point? How possible is it to go online and become insured under the federal program?
Yeah. So Pat's talking about healthcare.gov, which has been infamous in recent months since it launched on October 1st. And yes, there's been a lot of troubles and glitches with the website. And trust me, I've been in the thick of it. I've been able to enroll several people this week, and that's been really promising and exciting. So it is going through. Some people may be stuck in the process. So maybe someone started an application in October or November when it wasn't working well, and now you're just frustrated. So for those people out there, please do come on Sunday or call and make an appointment, because I might have some workarounds or at least be able to give you some helpful hints. So, yeah, the website's definitely improving, and there are some new workarounds and things they've been doing to make it work better. But, of course, there are still some problems. So,
Crystal, can you briefly describe what the process looks like at this point? If someone tries to do it on their own, what are they going to encounter?
Yeah, so if someone is going to healthcare.gov to look at their options, well, first you can see different plans, so different plans through Moda Health and Primera Blue Cross, which are the two companies offering insurance plans in Alaska through healthcare.gov. So you can go and compare some of those. You can actually put in your age and your zip code and answer some household information, and it will give you some plan comparisons and some prices for rates. And then if you want to go through the process, you can start by creating an account and then start the application process. And really, it's not wanting to know your medical history. Pre-existing conditions are no longer a barrier. It's not going to change your rates. It's not going to deny you for coverage if you have any pre-existing conditions. But what they want to know is household information and mainly income, because people can get lower costs if they're eligible through the marketplace, which is healthcare.gov. So you may qualify to get some tax credits to help lower those premium or monthly payments and make insurance more affordable.
So I think that's the most intriguing part of the current offering, is that the sticker price isn't actually the price that most people will wind up paying under the new program.
That's correct. And you can actually go and compare plans by not going through the entire application process. If you go to the main page and you click on see plans before I apply, you can put in your household information, including your income, and answer some other questions, and it will give you kind of a quote on what that sticker price might look like at a lower cost for you, again, if you're eligible. And just to give you an idea of that, for an individual making between $14,350 all the way up to $57,400 is going to qualify for some sort of lower payment, as well as a family making all the way up to $119,000. So there are some pretty incredible tax credits available, especially if you're on the lower end of that spectrum.
So now when you say a tax credit is available, this sounds to me like what you're saying is that a person would have to pay out the money, and then when you file your taxes in April of this year or next year, when would the tax credit be coming back to you?
Yeah, it's actually called an advanced premium tax credit, and you can either take it in advance, meaning that every month your payments are lowered, or you can take it at the end of the year when you file your taxes. So it could be based on your projected income for 2014, where then you would get it in advance, or it could be based on your actual income in 2014 if you were to take it at the end of the year. But I think most people are going to take it in advance to make it more affordable, especially younger adults, where they're kind of needing any extra help they can get to lower that monthly payment.
So one of the key needs of the system itself was to enroll as many young, healthy people into the mandatory health insurance program, so that the overall coverage pool would become larger nationwide and then lower costs, as it always does when you can expand the size of the pool. With the glitches in the sign-up program, do you have any sense of how the program is doing as far as getting that larger pool?
Yeah, well, you can read all the national news, and it really is state by state. Some states are doing really well, and they're being very successful, and I think states like Washington, states like even Kentucky, they ran their own exchanges, meaning they created their own websites. They really pushed behind it. They hired so many people. They had great marketing, and so I think they're capturing that younger audience altogether. So as far as Alaska is concerned, I'm not quite sure. I can't totally speak to that. I'm really just kind of dealing with it day-to-day on an individual basis. basis. I will say out of the people that I've enrolled, I'm getting some healthy young invincibles, as they're being called. So I'm encouraged by that.
Well, wonderful. So once again, the opportunity exists to have your personal help with being able to put this together. You're going to start out with a talk at about 2 o'clock at the library on Sunday.
That's correct.
And then after that, you're going to have a set of laptops set up so that people can actually go through the process while you're standing there saying, no, maybe you want to go that direction.
Don't click there. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay. I'll be there to kind of offer guidance. I also have screenshots play-by-play so we can talk about it together. If you're more private and you don't feel like being in a large crowd, you don't want to come to the event, that's fine. Call me and we can set up an appointment, and I'm happy to come to you as well. I'm meeting people where they're at. My phone number is 523-1147. If that's if you're driving, don't write that down. Just call 211 and they'll connect you to myself here in Juneau. So that's, again, 211, which is Alaska's information and referral line. So, yeah, if you want to be covered by January 1st, the deadline is December 23rd, which is this Monday. So if you want to start the new year being covered, then come on out and we'll try and get you set up. But open enrollment goes till March 31st. So people have until March 31st to get covered. If you don't have insurance after that date, then you may face a penalty at tax time. So not a threatening message, but just so you guys know out there.
There's a list of things that you've asked people to bring to the library with them if they're coming to your open house.
Yep.
They need their date of birth, social security number, verification of income, and that includes pay stubs or W-2 forms or your 2012 tax form, birth certificate or a U.S. residence card, passport, something that qualifies, that says that you're a U.S. citizen or your immigration status. Policy numbers of any current insurance of those in the household, and your email address and password. Did I get the list right?
That's right. And you don't need to necessarily have those physical documents if you know things like your social security number. Hopefully you know your birthday, and then also your income. You can come just with that in your head. So something to know. If you don't have an email, we'll help you set one up. That's not a problem.
Outstanding. Okay, so 2 o'clock at the library, 2 to 4 p.m., and if that doesn't work out for you and you still would like to have Crystal sit down and help you go through the enrollment process, you get a hold of her at 523-1147, and she'll be glad to come where you are and sit down and make this thing work for you.
That's right.
Crystal, thank you so much for telling us all this.
Thank you for having me.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD in Southeast communities through Pick, Click, Give. There are over 36 causes based in the Juneau-Douglas area alone, including KTOO Public Radio. The application period for the 2014 PFD starts on January 1st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
Eric Tollefson is doing a concert at McPheeters Hall on Thursday, December 6th. Let's listen to him on the way out here. Thursday, December 26th at McPheeters Hall, 8 p.m. So a good concert coming up there. You've been listening to KTOO News' Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. You might circle your calendar for that 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock presentation on the Obamacare program at the library today or this weekend. We are KTOO in Juno. We broadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, and in Juno, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for our national programming comes to you from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much, listeners like you.